from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A ceasefire appeared to be taking hold in Ukraine Friday after a modified version of a Russian peace proposal was adopted by the involved parties at talks in Minsk. Former Ukrainian President Leonid Kuchma, Alexander Zakarchenko, the Prime Minister of the self-proclaimed People's Republic of Donetsk, OSCE envoy Heidi Tagliavini, the Russian ambassador to the Ukraine Mikhail Zurabov, and Igor Plotnitsky of the People's Republic of Lugansk made a joint official statement upon the signing of the 14-point ceasefire agreement in Minsk Friday. RT's Paula Slyer filed this report from Donetsk.
We've just received a statement that was issued by the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in which it says that it is assessing carefully the anti-Russian rhetoric that has been emerging from the NATO summit in Wales. The Russian Foreign Ministry saying that the sentiments being expressed there show that the West supports fascism and extremism, including the right sector here in Ukraine. Now, a short time ago, there was a confirmation on the official Twitter page of the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, in which he said that a preliminary agreement had been signed between the sides. The sides, of course, being representatives of the Lugansk and Donetsk Republic, as well as members of the Kiev authorities and a representative from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. They have been meeting in the Belarusian capital of Minsk. We're also being told that the agreement outlines some 14 points that include items such as a humanitarian corridor for the safe passage of both humanitarian aid and refugees. It talks about the exchange of prisoners. It talks about control. One of the requests from the representatives of the Donetsk Republic, for example, is that there be a 50-kilometer perimeter around the republic that is a demilitarized zone. The hope is that this agreement will bring to an end some 5 months of fighting that have seen more than 2,200 people killed, many more injured, and many more displaced. It has been hailed as a breakthrough agreement. Of course, party to the agreement was Russia and, as I mentioned earlier, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But here on the ground, the fighting is continuing. We are receiving reports that there is heavy shelling on the outskirts of Donetsk. We're also hearing from anti-government fighters that they have information that a long column of armored vehicles, tanks, and Ukrainian soldiers is making its way right now from the city of Dnipropetrovsk to Donetsk. At the same time, the anti-government fighters say that they have managed to break through a cordon that was set up by the Ukrainian army at the entrance to the city of Mariupol. So we're just waiting to see how quickly the news of a ceasefire agreement can filter down to the ground and stop what certainly has been a traumatic half year for people living in this part of Ukraine.
According to Russian and Ukrainian media reports, government and rebel troops laid down their arms as the ceasefire agreement became effective at about 11 a.m. New York time. Despite agreement on almost all of the technical issues, the two sides avoided discussion of the main issue between them, namely the status of Ukraine's southeastern regions. The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic and Lugansk People's Republic have been seeking independence from Kiev and the creation of the state of Novorossiya, or New Russia. But according to the Donetsk Republic's prime minister, the question of the status of the two regions was not a priority. Zakarchenko told reporters after the meeting, quote, "The most important thing now is to stop the bloodshed," close quote. It was decided that negotiations on the status of the republics would begin once the military conflict is settled. The agreement was welcomed by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Stefan Dujarric, the Secretary General's spokesperson in New York, issued the following statement Friday.
The Secretary General welcomes the positive news that today's consultations between the contact group and representatives of armed groups have resulted in the agreement of a ceasefire. He welcomes the recent discussions between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia have played in part in today's breakthrough and strongly encourages those contacts to continue. The Secretary General stresses that credible and comprehensive monitoring and verification are essential elements for successful implementation of the ceasefire and the peace plan.
Derek Mbata has more. He reports from the United Nations.
Mr. Dujarric said the Secretary General encourages all who committed to the agreement to display goodwill and take concrete steps towards urgent, full, and effective implementation. Ban Ki-moon reiterates that there is no military solution to the crisis in Ukraine and strongly asserts that it is time to end this destructive conflict once and for all, the spokesperson added. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
And we will be following this as it develops. As the NATO summit in Wales drew to a close Friday, U.S. President Barack Obama addressed the assembled heads of state. He expressed skepticism over the Ukrainian ceasefire announcement.
Our alliance is fully united in support of Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, and its right to defend itself. To back up this commitment, all 28 NATO allies will now provide security assistance to Ukraine. This includes non-lethal support to the Ukrainian military, like body armor, fuel, and medical care for wounded Ukrainian troops, as well as assistance to help modernize Ukrainian forces, including logistics and command and control. Here in Wales, we also sent a strong message to Russia that actions have consequences. Today, the United States and Europe are finalizing measures to deepen and broaden our sanctions across Russia's financial, energy, and defense sectors. At the same time, we strongly support President Poroshenko's efforts to pursue a peaceful resolution to the conflict in his country. The ceasefire announced today can advance that goal, but only if there is follow-through on the ground. Pro-Russian separatists must keep their commitments, and Russia must stop its violations of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Responding to a question from one reporter, the president appeared inclined to add more sanctions against Russia over its alleged hand in Ukraine's civil war, despite the ceasefire agreement.
If this ceasefire does take effect and appears to be holding, would you and your European counterparts back away from these sanctions that you say you've prepared, or do you feel that it's important to levy these sanctions regardless of this ceasefire agreement?
With respect to the ceasefire agreement, obviously we are hopeful, but based on past experience, also skeptical that, in fact, the separatists will follow through and the Russians will stop violating Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. So it has to be tested. And I know that the Europeans are discussing at this point the final shape of their sanctions measures. It's my view that if you look at President Poroshenko's plan, it is going to take some time to implement. And as a consequence, for us to move forward based on what is currently happening on the ground with sanctions, while acknowledging that if, in fact, the elements of the plan that has been signed are implemented, then those sanctions could be lifted, is a more likely way for us to ensure that there's follow-through. But that's something that we'll consult closely with our European partners to determine. I do want to point out, though, that the only reason that we're seeing this ceasefire at this moment is because of both the sanctions that have already been applied and the threat of further sanctions, which are having a real impact on the Russian economy and have isolated Russia in a way that we have not seen in a very long time.
Here in the U.S., police arrested hundreds of protesters across the country during a nationwide walkout Thursday by fast food workers over low wages and poor working conditions. The workers seek to see their wages rise from a current average of about $8 an hour to $15 an hour. We have this report from Press TV.
The demonstrators were arrested outside fast food restaurants in over 150 cities. By the afternoon, organizers reported over 430 arrests nationwide. Most of the detentions occurred in Detroit, with the police rounding up over 40 workers. New York City and Chicago also witnessed around 20 arrests each. The protesters are demanding a minimum wage of $15 per hour, which is double the salary they currently receive. Protesters also want their employers to provide them with complete insurance coverage and improve their working conditions. Joining us from the U.S. via Skype is Tim King, editor at GlobalNewsCenter.com. Can you please tell us what's going on with these strikes and why are so many people being detained?
You know, I find an analogy with Occupy. This was the whole point of Occupy Wall Street, was the way that the upper 1% is controlling the 99. These folks are the 99%. They're the folks that make sure that we eat here in America. They work hard and they are making a non-living wage. $15 an hour is you know, it's about $30,000 a year. And that's not very much to ask for, it seems. So Detroit, you referenced Detroit. Detroit's such a hard-hit city in America. It's one of the worst violent crime rates. Endless closed-down buildings and factories and homes. And so people are struggling there. And I don't think they're asking for too much. And I think that the police reaction to it is just the same thing that we keep seeing in the United States over and over and over again. It's violence, it's arrests, suppressing free speech. It's a very frustrating time for these people, I can only imagine.
Now, if these demonstrators decide to stretch this out for a while, what kind of impact could this have on their employers and the local economy?
Well, I don't think that the impact would be felt in the local economy in anything but a good way. I think that the shareholders of these big corporations might take a hit in their wallet, which is fine with, I think, a lot of Americans today. They're just tired of the imbalance, and they're tired of watching people struggle and not be able to pay their bills. In previous generations, one working person in a family could make ends meet, and that's totally a thing of the past. So I just think that the police need to back off and let their voices be heard so that they can find these small things that they're asking for. $15 an hour is not much.
Could you please put into perspective what $8 an hour implies? Like, what? I mean, how far does it stretch? Throw out some averages of, you know, the housing costs in a big city or even a mid-sized city for that matter, when someone's living off of $8 an hour working full time.
Yeah, I don't think they're living well at all. $8 an hour would not really pay rent in the most low rent parts of this country. Now, granted that our economy is falling and some of the prices for rent and housing costs are lower than maybe they were a few years ago, with the housing bubble being, you know, popped as it was. But I would say that $8 an hour, it's virtually almost impossible to support anything but a single person living in the most minimal type of conditions. And, you know, this isn't good for people. They need to be able to live safely and well and have security and all of those things that every person in this world wants. And so I don't think they're asking for too much. I know it's hard for people in other countries to imagine. They see Americans as living, you know, high off the hog, and it's largely true. But the people that are working so hard to make all of it happen are just, they're the ones that are paying the dues, and the profits need to be reduced a little bit so that they can live well and we can have, you know, happy people in this country. It seems not that much to ask for.
Argentina is taking steps to contravene a U.S. federal court decision that the country must pay $1.3 billion worth of debt to so-called vulture fund bondholders who purchased the defaulted paper for pennies on the dollar. The actions by Buenos Aires may end up costing the U.S. billions in Argentine's banking business. We have this report from Telesur.
The Argentinian Senate approved Wednesday a sovereign debt law which aims to sidestep U.S. Judge Thomas Grace's recent ruling in favor of vulture fund creditors. For what this will mean for Argentina's ongoing battle, here's our Argentine correspondent, Leonel Poletti Caruti.
A full Senate hearing to debate the bill submitted by Argentine President Cristina Fernandez commenced this Wednesday, which makes available the payment to the bondholders which entered the 2005 and 2010 debt swaps in Buenos Aires without the threat of Grieza's seizures.
We are paying the bondholders, we are paying the Center for Investment Disputes, and we are paying back Repsol. Argentina has demonstrated its willingness and ability to pay. They can't say that we are in default, and all because of these speculative funds who are outlaws, really.
In the lead-up to today's debate, the governing Front for Victory coalition amended the debt swap bill to add France as a possible location for debt payments.
Argentina has shown in international forums that it's prepared to fight for what it considers its sovereign right, for undertaking a debt restructuring that has been successful, for not giving into this discretionary will of a state judge, which paralyzes and stops the restructuring process, not even applying principles that are built into American justice.
Argentina's opposition continues to reject this bill submitted by the government.
I would continue to make payments at the bank that was agreed upon in 2005, because I would use the 93% of bondholders that entered the swap to trigger legal action against the American state, telling them that the money that belongs to them cannot go through because of a ruling that doesn't permit compliance.
The upper house is expected to give its approval to the government's bill establishing the local payment of debt and a package of consumer protection bills that includes amendments to the anti-hoarding law. From Buenos Aires, Leonel Poblete Goluti, Telesur.
In Chile, three more officers have been charged with the murder of folk singer Victor Jara, killed September 16, 1973, 5 days after the military coup that initiated the U.S.-backed dictatorship of General Augustino Pinochet. Army officers Hernan Chancon Soto and Patricio Vasquez Donoso were charged Wednesday by Chilean Judge Miguel Vasquez with kidnapping and aggravated homicide. Ex-Army prosecutor Ramon Melo Silva was also charged as an accomplice. Jara's widow, Joan Jara, said at a press conference, quote, "This decision has to be celebrated, and we hope this investigation can continue. We know this marks a milestone," closed quote. Jara, whose songs dealt with social and political issues, was arrested with thousands of other supporters of socialist President Salvador Allende during the coup in September of 1973. At least 5,000 were held in the Santiago Stadium, where Jara was tortured and killed, a stadium that now bears his name. An investigation has shown that he was shot in the head and his body was riddled with 45 bullets. The three ex-Army officials now being tried are in addition to eight former officers charged in late 2012 and early 2013 with the killing of the popular singer and songwriter. Jara's family filed a civil lawsuit last year in the United States, accusing former Chilean Army Lieutenant Pedro Barrientos Núñez of ordering soldiers to torture the singer. Barrientos, who left Chile in 1989 and is living in the U.S., is part of the group of officers who also face criminal charges in Chile related to the singer's killing. The Chilean government estimates about 3,100 people were killed during Pinochet's rule, including about 1,200 who were forcibly disappeared. Approximately 700 military officials still await trial in Chile, and about 70 have been jailed for crimes against humanity. Next month, we'll see elections in Brazil that could be among the world's most important in the past decade. President Dilma Rousseff, like her predecessor, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was popularly known as Lula, has followed a path of regional integration with a group of other nations in the hemisphere with progressive governments like Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Uruguay. Brazil has also joined with Russia, China, India, and South Africa in the so-called BRICS grouping, which has been the focal point of an emerging multipolar world order. This summer, Rousseff hosted the BRICS conference, where the formation of a bank and other financial structures were announced that could offer developing nations an alternative to the austerity and other neoliberal policies imposed by the IMF and World Bank as a condition of financing. Until last month, Rousseff was widely expected to be a shoo-in for re-election. However, an airplane crash that some have termed suspicious took the life of a rival candidate whose chances to win were virtually non-existent and resulted in another candidate coming to the fore who was now actually leading the incumbent president in some polls. For more, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, who spoke with us from Managua, Nicaragua, Friday. So we got a lot to cover. Why don't you just start kicking it off?
Well, and the main stuff in the region has to do with the events in Brazil, around the elections in Brazil, which are hugely important for the whole region because Brazil's such a huge country.
Yeah, and I'll remind our listeners that we had the monkey wrench thrown into that election with a plane crash and one of the candidates being replaced.
Yeah, that's right. And one also has to bear in mind that there are also elections pretty much in, around the same time. I think they're all in the month of October next month in Uruguay and Bolivia. The elections coming up in October in Bolivia are pretty much a foregone conclusion.
Oh, yeah.
Because the government of Evo Morales is so popular and has made such really quite dramatic advances over the last 7 or 8 years in which President Evo Morales has been in power in government in Bolivia. And there seems to be very little doubt that he will get re-elected.
Yeah.
So the elections are more interesting from, or more uncertain, perhaps, is the more appropriate word, from the in Uruguay, and especially of special importance in Brazil.
Mm.
Because, as you pointed out, the recent tragic accident in which Eduardo Campos, the Socialist Party candidate, died, has opened the way for the person who at that time was his vice presidential candidate, Marina Silva, to mount a very serious challenge to what has been the status quo in Brazil ever since the early 2000s, when Ignacio Lula da Silva was elected on behalf of the Workers' Party there in Brazil. And ever since the early 2000s, Ignacio Lula da Silva has been the president, and when he became ineligible to stand because he'd already been re-elected previously, he passed the baton on to his Workers' Party colleague, Dilma Rousseff.
Mm-hmm.
And she's now running for re-election,
right?
In the elections that are due in October, and the race is basically between her and this candidate for the Socialist Party, Marina Silva.
Right.
Now, the Socialist Party is a misnomer,
right? Like,
very much so.
It's like the Labour Party in the UK, for example, which does nothing for Labour, of course.
Yeah, or the Socialist Party in France.
Yeah, exactly.
Any of the Socialist parties in Europe have also the Spanish PSOE has completely discredited in terms of its commitment to advancing the interests of the working classes, the less advantaged classes in Spanish society, and that's true across Europe.
Sure.
And that's also true in Brazil in terms of the orientation of Marina Silva. And it's very interesting. I mean, there's an excellent article, and I don't know if it's been translated, by Emir Sade, the Brazilian analyst, writing about, and it's up in Telesur, that article, and he writes about how the recent events in Brazil, including electoral debates between the various candidates, have highlighted the extent to which Marina Silva's political agenda is extremely right-wing, extremely neoliberal.
Yeah.
In his article, Emir Sada highlights three main points in which Marina Silva's position blatantly favor foreign capital,
yeah,
and foreign interests, foreign economic interests against the nationalist interests of Brazil. And those are her policy, in particular with regard to the central bank. Because, as I understand it, the central bank in Brazil is subject to the government, and Marina Silva is proposing that the central bank in Brazil be made independent.
Mm.
And of course, that's kind of code for saying, "Well, let's have our financial and monetary policy decided by the international banking system."
Right. If it's independent, it means it's independent of democratic control. That's basically
exactly
what it means. Yeah.
And that's dead right. So, and Emir Sada is highlighting that as a potential blow against in fact, all his points are relevant to the issue of broader regional integration, because although Brazil has always dragged its feet in comparison with the incredibly dynamic integration processes that were promoted by Nuestro Comandante Eterno, Hugo Chavez, they, for example, in relation to the Banco del Sur was an idea to develop an independent international banking system for South America. And that idea was actually floated way back in, I think it was 2006 or even before. And it's always been held back. And it's just beginning to take baby steps in regional terms of, in terms of its economic importance. But that the development of that Banco del Sur was always held back by Brazil because the financial interests in Brazil are so powerful.
That's a key, you know, that's a key instrument of regional integration. And with Brazil as a member of the BRICS and actually hosting the BRICS conference last month, was it, or the month before, the most recent one, Brazil is in a swing position in terms of the global movement towards multipolarity and the regional movement towards integration. And the political situation there is more complex than it is, say, in Venezuela or Nicaragua. And that leaves Rousseff somewhat vulnerable, and so this election is key in terms of going forward.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in the United States, in the State Department, they're probably rubbing their hands with glee at the prospect of Marina Silva becoming the Brazilian president, because she's like a dream come true for them. She's going to implement a neoliberal agenda if she's elected.
Another happy coincidence after an airplane crash, yeah.
Yeah, and Wayne Madsen, the journalist that with a very strong security background, right. It is of the opinion that the crash that in which Eduardo Campos died was deliberately engineered by the security interests, the intelligence interests in the United States,
yep.
Because opening that Campos' death, as we've said, opened the way for Marina Silva, and so, and she's going to implement policies that are very much to the liking, and perhaps even dictated by individuals like right. George Soros, for example, who's a major influence and perhaps a major funder too of Marina Silva's campaign. But what seems to have happened following Campos' death is that the Brazilian right wing realized that they had a real opportunity here to challenge Dilma Rousseff and the political control that the Workers' Party have had under Dilma Rousseff and Ignacio Lula da Silva over the last, what is it, 15 years?
Yeah.
Almost 15 years.
Wow.
And so they dumped the other right-wing candidates. Effectively, that seems to have been what happened. All the financial and political support seems to have shifted from the other right-wing candidate, Neves, I think his name is. I've forgotten.
Yeah.
But his support has seems to have been shifted to support Marina Silva because she has a much better chance of defeating Dilma Rousseff. I mean, the polls show that although in a first round, Dilma Rousseff would probably come out with 30-something percent of the
right.
vote, on a second round, Marina Silva would actually defeat her by about 10%,
yeah.
which is a massive margin of victory if that were to come true.
And
it's a very, very serious election.
She's stepping into a position where, you know, when she was vice president, the presidential candidate was in number three. The other right-wing candidate was number two. I think it was like 33% to 26%. And then third place was like in the teens.
Yeah, I know, or even less, around 10%. So, and it's quite a dramatic change. And one can see that in regional terms, there's a great interest and much concern among the progressive governments that Marina Silva should not defeat Dilma Rousseff, because apart from that electoral commitment to make the Brazil central bank independent, and another key policy that Emir Sada points out in his article is in relation to Mercosur. And Marina Silva has said very explicitly that if she becomes president, she will play down Mercosur as a tool of regional integration and instead opt for bilateral trade deals.
Mm.
And what is she signaling there? She's signaling
right.
a free trade deal with the United States and
yep,
Brazil.
That's right.
And so that's, you know, that would be a kind of dagger in the heart of regional integration in South America. So and that's that second point that Emir Sada makes is also a dramatic threat to regional integration, in particular regional economic independence, which has made such progress over the last 4 or 5 years. despite the foot dragging imposed by the southern cone elites in Brazil, Paraguay, Argentina, and Uruguay.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.